Children are struggling with anxiety during what was supposed to be a more normal school year. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Masks, vaccines, and homeschooling have taken a toll on our kids' mental health. What does the research tell us, and how can we help students cope? Also, Broward County is using money to entice workers to get vaccinated. $500 for those who get a shot. Are financial incentives the best way to get more people to get their shots? And finally,
and they go, oh, they must come in and command the room and just make decisions. And the truth is that all of them are serving the director's story.
Carlos Rafael Rivera, a professor at UM, composed the music for the Netflix series The Queen's Gambit. He won an Emmy last night. We'll go back to our conversation from last year. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. This school year is supposed to be the closest quote-unquote normal year that we've had in a while. Kids and their teachers are back in person, in the classroom, full-time. But the back and forth over mask mandates and the surge of the Delta variant have disrupted students' learning and made this year just as uncertain as 2020. Students and their caregivers are experiencing anxiety at alarming rates. Joining me now is Dr. Jill Ehrenreich-May. She directs the Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program at the University of Miami. Dr. Ehrenreich-May, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I also want to post the number out because I'd love to hear from parents, from caregivers. How are you and your kids handling the stresses of getting back to school, the mask mandates, the Delta variant, everything that's going on? What's it like for you? Has the anxiety gone up? Call in 800-743-9576. Again, that's 800-743-WLRN. You can also post your comments or questions on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Doctor, I wanted to start with you. You're a parent. You have school-age children. How are you dealing with this school year? Is it like 2020?
I think we're a little bit more used to it, I suppose, than we were last year. I feel like, last year everything felt kind of new and different, and the quarantines felt, you know, kind of unexpected when they happened. But I felt like this year has been a little bit smoother for myself and my kids thus far. And, you know, I've said this about children when I've talked about this topic before, but I think kids are very resilient. You know, this is something they've been dealing with for a good proportion of their lives. And so seeing them adjust and adapt has been gratifying for me personally.
And you talk about those adjustments, but like, what are some of the big adjustments that you've had to make in your life, for you and your kids?
Well, you know, I think that for kids who are feeling more anxious or who are, experiencing this with some level of distress, you know, sometimes we have to be very, very thoughtful about maybe routines that we've gotten into during the pandemic that are not super helpful for our children in terms of managing their own distress. So for example, you know, if my kids or other kids that we work with might express distress about things that are related to COVID, you know, I might be very thoughtful about listening to them, normalizing their anxiety about the pandemic, but also thinking about the things that we know are helpful to kids in terms of coping with that distress. I don't want to build on their fear by communicating even more danger and more threat than is necessary regarding some of these situations. But, you know, it can be confusing for both parents and adults right now. Not everything is safe to do. And so we have to live within a certain amount of restrictions, but we also need to be mindful of the things that might be contributing to some of the rising anxiety and depression rates in youth.
I wondered, for example, I mean, because there are a couple things. Let's look, for example, at the Delta variant. And, you know, we see we saw the spike over the last couple of months, mm-hmm. and the numbers going up. How do kids, and, you know, again, your kids, but other kids you've seen or heard about, how are they dealing with that? Because I'm wondering if they're watching the news the way we do, the adults do, or are they reading up on this as much as we are? Maybe they're ahead of us.
Well, you know, I think they may be ahead of a lot of adults in terms of being, you know, confident and comfortable with certain restrictions. Again, they've been dealing with this, particularly children who've been back in school for a very long time. You know, I think about my kids wearing, you know, they're wearing their masks all day without complaining and sort of have become used to those types of things. But I think, you know, for many of our children, this has been, you know, a difficult time with the Delta variant coming back in, because I think to a certain extent earlier in the summer, it may have felt to people as they were going into summer camps and other experiences that restrictions were lifting and they could, you know, move around and become less socially isolated, which we know has been a big factor in ongoing anxiety and depression. And then to have the restrictions come back in, you know, especially close to the school year, I think was a big adjustment for everybody, because it sort of brings back in a number of the factors that isolate kids more from each other and from interacting in more normalized ways.
And you know, the other thing too is this, because and you talk about the restrictions, so we talk about masks, and mm-hmm. you know, I wonder how kids are handling when you have, you know, the school boards debating over masks, and then you have politicians jumping into the fray, and then it becomes this political issue, and then you've got parents on both sides outside of a school board building with signs, some saying we need to mask, and others saying, "Hey, my freedom, my kid." How does that impact children? How are they feeling when they see that? When they see us fighting over them?
Well, you know, I, you know, without getting into the political side of it, I mean, I think that children model, you know, learn from the models that are around them, and they listen to the information that their parents are giving them, and they hear that information oftentimes as being factual. And so being very simple and clear and evidence-based in the materials and the information that we're giving to our children, presenting these things at a very developmentally appropriate level so that they understand what they're being asked to do and why. I think those are big factors in whether somebody is going to approach that situation with a lot of distress, or whether they're going to see it as part of kind of the norm right now, and things that are kind of expected and less upsetting to deal with.
Again, talking about the anxieties and the stresses that children are feeling, but also their caregivers. Even though we're back to, you know, kids are back in the classroom, we see that that anxiety is still there, that life isn't back to, quote, normal, not yet anyway. We want to hear your thoughts on this, especially if you're a parent or caregiver, because I know the kids are in school right now, should be. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN, or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let me go to the phones. I've got Omar in Fort Lauderdale. Omar,
hello.
Are you a parent?
Yes, I am. I have a 5-year-old and 3-year-old. The 5-year-old just started kindergarten, and I feel as though kids are very resilient. They understand the importance of wearing a mask, and it's the parents and the adults in this who are acting childish, of not really considering the students' health, but more considered about their political and personal views. It's stressful. My 5-year-old asked, "Is coronavirus is over?" And I'm like, "No, it's not over. It's part of our life. It's going to be here forever now." And he says, "Okay," and then continues playing.
That's interesting. Just you say it's going to be here forever, and they just say, "Okay." Well, Omar, first of all, I'm glad to hear that they're doing all right. And I remember kindergarten. I do. I actually do. Those are fun times. Omar, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Doctor, yeah, you hear that. Yeah. Kids, you said it yourself, kids are resilient, maybe more than us.
Yeah, you know, and I think that, you know, you can look at the rates of anxiety and depression in adults and kids and know that these things have gone up in both groups. But, you know, 4 in 10 adults have had anxiety or depression during the pandemic. A quarter of the youth, you know, have reported increased depression. A quarter, you know, 20% have reported greater anxiety. And yet, you know, we see, you know, so many good examples like Omar just brought up of, you know, how on the other hand, you know, some kids have really adapted and adjusted to this as part of their sort of normal existence. And I do think that that starts with caregivers. I think that the idea of this being something that is, yes, frustrating, and yes, it can be upsetting and uncertain at times, importantly, and an uncertainty is a big factor in anxiety. But at the same time, we can handle it. You can deal with this. I believe in you. Those kind of positive coping messages from a parent, even if they're feeling a little distressed themselves, is really important to child adjustment.
Mm. Let me go back to the phones. I want to go to South Miami, and Janet's been waiting. Janet, welcome to the program.
Thank you, guys. I have an 11-year-old that has been at home since March of 2020, and this was her first year back, first year in middle school, which was kind of nerve-wracking in itself, but we talk a lot, and like our guest was just saying, we tell her, you know, that all things, this is just a rough patch, and that, you know, we only have control over ourselves, and we just have to take care of ourselves and wear a mask, and keep our distance and play by the rules, and we will be safe. She has a countdown for her birthday, which is when she can get vaccinated. So she feels that that would give her a little bit more freedom. But we do talk a lot about how this kind of stinks and how we will all get through it all together. And we do a lot of outdoor stuff. We'll ride bike when she gets home from school and I get out of work and things like that. So we try to do things outside of school that's not just that. And she seems to be so far handling well, to the point that she actually said she might have wished to go back on virtual learning again.
Wow.
Which is kind of scary.
That's interesting.
She's thriving. She's doing well.
First of all, that's good to hear. I thought that was, Janet, what you said was really interesting, the countdown to her birthday, countdown to being able to get that vaccination shot. I think that's the first time I've ever heard a kid excited about getting a shot, first of all. So that's a positive. That's a good, I guess that's a good thing.
Yes, that's the example that we have all set. I have elderly parents also. So, you know, she sees it as part of taking care of the family. And that's all it's to it.
Well,
and that's what we've always said.
Janet, thank you so much for sharing, and good to see, also hear that, you know, you'd spend some time outside. But I think, as you said, talking to each other, really, really important. Janet, thanks for the call and for the insight, and that your child stay safe as well, please. You know, doctor, the very interesting, too, is because she said something that triggered for me this question of how has this impacted children's social growth? First, there was the learning from home. But then now we're still trying to teach them social distancing and then the masks. But, you know, is that getting in the way of, because especially at that age, this is an important part of their social growth. They have to, you know, learn how to talk to people and you know, relate to other people.
You know, I think it's kind of interesting that the first two callers have been a parent of a kindergartner and a parent of a rising middle schooler, because, you know, those are two big transition points in social and emotional development, as well as in school, in terms of maturing and learning how to interact with others in a very new way from what you've been used to. And, you know, I think we can all fairly say that, you know, the experiment of having kids online, you know, was something that we all had to do, and it was acceptable from that perspective, but it doesn't necessarily help a lot with social development. And, you know, the kinds of things that help with combating the social isolation that might be leading to some of these rising anxiety and depression rates were much more difficult for people in a more isolated way. So, you know, some of these transitions might be a little rougher for some kids than others because they haven't been sort of interacting with everyone perhaps as more typically as if they had been in school and interacting in a more typical progression. But I guess going back to sort of our last caller and really re-emphasizing how resilient kids are, that given the opportunity to grow, even if they are sort of a little bit behind in terms of comfort, anxiety, and sort of their interactions and their social skills right now, that these things can develop, you know, as kids get back into a routine at school.
I'm talking with Dr. Jill Ehrenreich-May. She directs the Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program at UM. We're talking about supporting kids' mental health during the school year, but not just kids, adults too, because this is affecting all of us. And we'd love to hear from you and how are your kids doing, you know, with all of this? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Or again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN. sundial. The other thing too, because I want to get back to the anxiety and looking at the research, and this is research from Kaiser Family Foundation, and it shows that adult anxiety is up 30 to 40% more than normal. So yeah. Tell me what you're seeing with the parents and how they're handling this.
You know, really across children and adults, we see rates that are up to double versus pre-pandemic levels. This is something, caregiver anxiety, that we've been very concerned with in my program. We've been offering brief telehealth-based cognitive behavioral therapy for parents throughout the pandemic with the support of the University of Miami and the Children's Trust. And, you know, a lot of the parents who came to us, you know, were having to break from their normal routines of work, of course, because of quarantines or because of children needing to be home for their schooling, having financial difficulties, having other stressors in their lives, and then suddenly, you know, sort of their vision for how they were parenting their child or their understanding of how their child was getting school was completely upended for many of them as well. And so it's been an incredibly stressful time.
And, you know, I got to say, I myself am not a parent, but I one person I can attest to is my brother, who has three. And I know it was stressing him out as to the fact that this could be, you know, knocking them back a bit, that they could be falling behind. That, you know, if they're in this grade now, they may actually be a grade and a half back because of what was lost. That's got to be an anxiety too.
Sure. You know, all of us are worried about the academic performance. And I wonder, you know, to a certain extent, for me personally, anyway, I have felt like, you know, going through this and having things be sort of out of our control to a certain extent as a person who, you know, really cares about academic achievement, you know, in a way maybe has been good in terms of parenting them more effectively around their academic performance, understanding that this is just something that we're all having to deal with, right? Everybody is sort of similarly behind in a lot of ways, and we do what we can to help them as much as we can from home, you know, while managing work, while managing other things, and, you know, giving ourselves a little bit of grace as parents and, you know, allowing ourselves to take a break to, you know, refill our cup, so to speak, and really understand that if we're not feeling like we're taking care of ourselves, it's going to be much harder to support our children's learning. It's going to be hard to support them when they're stressed. And we're going to find ourselves doing or saying things that are not so helpful to, you know, them dealing with a stressful situation as is.
Yeah. And it was always, I found it fascinating watching him as he was, you know, when they were still learning from home, watching him as he was making sure they were even just getting up and making sure they were logging in on time and getting their breakfast and just, you know, doing their thing. Let me go back to the phones. I want to go to Michael in Miami. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So what about you? What you have a child in school.
I have a 10-year-old turning 11, going in his fifth year now, so fifth grade. And we sat out a year because of the closure of schools. And when schools reopened, we actually stayed virtual because of the, you know, like wearing a mask outside for PE and that type of thing. And my concern is essentially you're talking about something that affects, for his age group, it's one in a million. So it's a 0.003% morbidity. The hospitalization, the illness at his age is so exceptionally low. And yet we're now talking about Pfizer getting a vaccine for 5 to 12-year-olds, where, you know, if it was smallpox and the rate of death or polio and the rate of paralysis were, I would say, a true threat, I think that, you know, we would all agree that it's great that they had the vaccine before going into school. But COVID clearly doesn't affect children the same way it affects adults. Having the vaccine doesn't prevent you from spreading it to others. So really, we're putting our children through something that I defer to the doctor, the CDC, the NIH. We know that they're losing their ability to learn. Their social interaction is diminished. As it was just pointed out, they've lost a year of education already. I think we're taking things way too far for 5 to 12-year-olds, for sure.
Hmm. Well, I mean, and Michael, you know, I apologize. I don't have, you know, those statistics in front of me, but I know that we've spoken with, we've talked a lot about, you know, the children, and we do see you know, the rate of children in the hospital has gone up depending on age. And I don't have those numbers in front of me, so I cannot say for sure. But yes, I also know that from speaking to epidemiologists, the rate is a lot lower. But you're right, this is the stress, right? Is that, you know, it's the stress that we put on ourselves and our kids, and what chances are we willing to take? Because you know, I'm just listening to you, and you're saying, look, it's maybe the risk is not so low enough that we can, you know, do this without worrying about it. But there are parents, obviously, who may feel a little different. I don't know if you talk to them and, you know, if you see their point of view.
Okay. Should we not allow the children's parents to make that decision for them? If they want to wear seatbelts when they get in the car, you know, we have a law about seatbelts, but really at the end of the day, if you don't have a seatbelt in the car, that's you taking that risk. Again, having the vaccine doesn't prevent you from spreading it to someone else. What we're saying is children are not being hospitalized. They're not ill. And you don't have the number in front of you, but it's 0.003%. It's one in a million. So if you're going to mandate a vaccine for a child, just that alone,
well,
if you take the consideration of a 28% increase in the risk of getting COVID because of fear and anxiety, 28% increase, that's the CDC number. And that's considered a comorbidity. You know, if you have diabetes, if you're overweight, 28% is
just
I
got you. Michael, I have to stop. I apologize again because I don't have this stuff in front of me, so I can't, continue with that part of the conversation. But I hope that at least your child is doing all right and again, staying safe. And I do appreciate the call. You make good points. I do appreciate that. I want to jump in, get one more call in here before we finish up. Mark in Coconut Grove. Mark, welcome to the program. You also have a child in school.
Actually, she is homeschooled.
Oh, okay. But
she was homeschooled before the pandemic, so that wasn't actually much of disruption, which obviously contributed to her adaptation to it. But her life has always been taken out of its comfort zone as a matter of regular course. She tries new things. She meets new people. We keep the routine, I guess, to a healthy level, I would imagine, but not a monotonous level is the best way I can put it. So we've been fortunate that this whole thing hasn't really affected her too much in the realm of understanding a perception of a 9-year-old that does what she does. It's kind of just been another unusual thing amongst an ocean of unusual things in her life.
Mm. Mark, thank you so much for sharing with that with us. Again, more interesting points, and I love hearing from parents about what's going on with them and their children. I want to mention again, I'm talking with Dr. Jill Erin Reich-May. She directs the Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program at the University of Miami. Doctor, the other thing, too, the Biden administration had announced that $10.7 million in the American Rescue Plan was going to pediatric mental health. And I'm wondering, have you seen those dollars yet? Are we seeing it get out there?
Well, I believe a lot of that money is going to community agencies to support mental health services in some acute care settings, and also to pediatrics groups to try to be very thoughtful about screening. And I think that the screening and identification of kids who are at greater risk or who are having more anxiety and depression, you know, is incredibly important right now. And I think that just in general, you know, there are so many effective therapies out there for anxiety or depression that people can utilize, things that, you know, have efficacy rates that are 60-70% or more, you know, improvements. But there are not enough mental health providers available to see this rising need of children by a long shot. And so whatever dollars really can be put toward increasing the number of providers, the access to care, the access to brief interventions that might be able to help someone just even a small amount, I think are incredibly important priorities right now. And I certainly encourage and support, you know, more attention to this really incredible need out there.
To finish up, if parents have any questions about their kids and concerns about, you know, what their kids are feeling or going through, where would you recommend they turn to? Should they go to the schools?
You know, the schools have certainly gotten greater investment here in Florida around mental health services. I know our Office of Mental Health Services in Miami-Dade County, you know, has been incredibly thoughtful about their work in trying to increase evidence-based care. You know, they work also with a large number of community mental health agencies where people can turn. But I think the most important thing, whether you look for a private practitioner or whether you look for someone in our program or someone through the schools, or talk to your pediatrician, as mentioned, about sort of options, is really to focus on trying to access care that has an evidence base behind it, that has science supporting what they're doing. You know, things like cognitive behavioral therapy, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, those are the effective therapies for anxiety and depression that are out there, and they are quite effective. So really seeking those things out in particular is important.
She is Dr. Jill Ehrenreich-May. She directs the Child and Adolescent Mood and Anxiety Treatment Program at the University of Miami. Dr. Ehrenreich-May, I really appreciate the insight. Thanks for all the answers.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to mention, too, because we did get a call about, you know, child COVID rates, and I didn't, like I said, I didn't have that information in front of me. Here is something that we do have. As of August 26, this was information that was published by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association of Florida, saying that there were 311,102 COVID-19 cases in the state in children from infants to the age of 14. That's since the pandemic began. And we can get more numbers about how many of those cases were extreme, how many ended in death. And we could post that on our social media as well later on. Well, still to come, Broward County is using bonuses to entice workers to get vaccinated for COVID. Is it working? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governments are getting creative in their vaccination campaigns as many are still reluctant to get their shots. Broward County is now offering employees $500 to show proof of vaccination. They're also requiring regular COVID testing, and they're docking $20 per check for employees that remain unvaccinated. Is that convincing employees to get vaccinated? Is it working? Broward County Mayor Steve Geller joins us now to talk about this. Mayor, let me just ask, why use financial incentives to get Broward County workers vaccinated instead of requiring it the way that the federal government does?
Well, because federal government doesn't have Ron DeSantis running it. Florida does. The governor, as you are aware, has issued an executive order prohibiting local governments from doing that. The Florida legislature has gone along with that, and they passed a law. As someone who was in the legislature for 20 years, I love the Florida legislature, and I always respect the office of the governor, whoever is there, but I find it very ironic that the same people that go to Washington and say, oh, federal government, don't do anything on a national level because what works in New York doesn't work in North Dakota. When we go to them and say, well, governor, what works in Bradford County with a population of 28,000 doesn't work in Broward County with a population of nearly 2 million, they ignore us.
So is it fair to say, I mean, how significant a role is the governor's executive order banning vaccine mandates in designing this policy?
I don't know, because as you know, under the Sunshine Law, we are prohibited from speaking with other commissioners. But I can tell you that but for the governor's order, I know there would have been at least very substantial support to say that we would require our employees to be vaccinated, like so many private businesses are doing across the country, like the federal government is doing, but we can't. And we felt we had to do something. You may or may not be aware that during most of August, Broward County led the nation, not the state, the nation, in amount of people hospitalized. We were number one, Houston, Texas was number two, Miami was number three, and Los Angeles was number four. Los Angeles County has four times the population of Broward County, but we were still the number one in terms of total number of people hospitalized.
So
we had to do something.
A $500 bonus if you show proof of vaccination. Is it working? I mean, are you seeing the number of people?
We haven't started the program yet.
Oh, okay. I see. All right. But what have you heard from workers?
The program got good first.
I see.
Generally, we've heard good. Some of the people that were opposed to it seem relieved that we weren't threatening their jobs. If you work out the $500 bonus, if you show proof of vaccination versus the $20 surcharge every 2 weeks, which means $520 in the first year, 26 pay periods times $20, it's a $1,000 swing if you can show that you're vaccinated. We have every legal right to do this. It complies with the governor's order. We think it is a meaningful step. Would we have done more without the governor's order or the statute? Probably, but at least we feel like we're doing as much as we can.
And I mean, have you heard from anybody who says, wait a second, you're going to dock my pay? Have you gotten any pushback?
We're not docking anybody's pay. We are doing a health insurance surcharge, just like we do for tobacco. Beyond question, if people get COVID, it's going to cost the Broward County a lot more than the $20 every 2 weeks. It is a surcharge on their health insurance, which we are absolutely legally permitted to do.
But have you heard anybody push back on that?
Yeah, we've heard minor pushback, but nothing significant. We actually met with the unions in advance. Broward County, there's 9 county commissioners. All 9 of us are Democrats. We're very pro-labor. We met with our unions in advance, told them we're doing this. And they seemed pleased that we weren't firing people, and they also liked the $500 bonus. So none of our unions actively objected to this.
So it's $500 if you show proof of vaccination, as you said, for the worker. That's a $1,000 swing. But what's it going to cost Broward County?
Possibly nothing. If 100% of our employees get vaccinated, we have about 6,800 employees that work for the county. So that would be $3.4 million, but we're paying for that out of federal COVID relief funds, which we're permitted to do. When I said county employees, you need to understand the county constitutional officers, the sheriff, the supervisor of election, the clerk of court, and the property appraiser. Even though the county pays for them, their benefits and salaries are determined by those people, so they are not covered under our plan. There's an additional 6,800 that report directly to the county administrator, and those are the ones that are covered.
I'm speaking with Broward County Mayor Steve Geller. Broward County employees can get a $500 bonus starting in October if they show proof of vaccination. And if not, they're going to be charged $20. It's a surcharge, as the mayor said, if they remain unvaccinated. And that goes towards their health care. You can read more about this story, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Mayor, I want to shift gears here from the pandemic, and I want to talk about the push to inspect more condo buildings.
Yes, sir.
Across Broward County. Of course, this follows the Surfside tragedy. What's the reinspection process currently, and how would you want to see it changed?
Currently, there are only 2 counties in the state that have the reinspection process. There are Miami-Dade and Broward. Currently, it's done every 40 years. The task force, which I appointed, which consisted of 4 legislators, 4 municipal officials, engineers, condominium attorneys, representative of condominium associations, land use lawyers, I mean, large group of people. The recommendation was to make that every 30 years instead of every 40, the first after 30, and then reinspections after 10. But we had a lot of other recommendations. The biggest ones probably apply to reserves. Under current law, condominiums are supposed to reserve for big repairs, but by a simple majority vote, they can waive that so that they then have nothing when they need expensive repairs. we said if you're going to waive it, it should require a three-quarters vote instead of a majority vote. And also they would have to do a reserve study. The biggest thing to come out of this is that people who think they're saving money by skimping on maintenance are wrong. It will cost them much more in the long term. It's like you can't say, I'm going to save money by not doing oil changes in my car. It'll save you a little money for a while, but in the long run, it's going to be a lot more expensive. Skimping on maintenance will be a lot more expensive.
Do you know how many buildings are 30 years or older that need that inspection?
No, I have no idea, but I can tell you that in Dade and Broward County, particularly on the ocean, there are thousands of them.
Do we know? I mean, is there a backlog? Because I was wondering, how many inspectors do you need?
Well, under the plan that we are talking about, it would be phased in. So everyone would have to be inspected within roughly 2 years. If the building is more than 30 years old, it would have 3 years. If it's more than 30 but less than 40, they'd have 3 years. You can't do everyone at the same time.
Is this the kind of thing, though, that needs like a companion legislation in Tallahassee?
Absolutely. And that's why I appointed four legislators to the committee. So there are four legislators that have already voted for our task force recommendations. So I am quite confident that the legislature will at least take it seriously. Understand, we had over 26 hours of hearings and four legislators on the committee that voted for this. So I don't know that the legislature will adopt it, but I can guarantee you it'll be taken seriously.
And you talk about that issue of cost and, you know, yes, people putting cost aside because they don't want to deal with it now. But do you think that is still the attitude, considering, I mean, the tragedy that occurred, that maybe people might be, well, no, let's if there's a problem, let's pay for it. Let's fix it now.
Some won't. When I was in the House and Senate in the late 90s, representing Hallandale, at the time was a very senior population in the condos. And I would talk to them about reserves, and they would say, Sonny, don't talk to me about needing a roof in 10 years. I'm going to be dead in 10 years. My children will worry about it. So a lot of the seniors just did not want to do reserves, did not want to pay for maintenance because they would tell me I'm on a fixed income, I can't afford it, and I'm not going to worry about what's going to happen in 10 years. But the fact is, if you're living in a condominium, you're actually paying for the use of your roof right now. And people need to understand it is much cheaper to properly maintain your condominium than to make structural repairs on it because you haven't done the waterproofing or the painting or the paving.
That is a very good point, but I also think the scary part of it is what you said before that, and that may be one of the challenges that we face moving forward. Yeah, Broward County Mayor Steve Geller, always appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Anytime. If you want me again, call me.
We always will, definitely. Well, still to come, a University of Miami composer takes home an Emmy for his work on a popular Netflix series. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The limited Netflix series, The Queen's Gambit, was one of the big winners from last night's Emmys, taking home 11 trophies. The show follows the story of Beth Harmon, an orphan chess prodigy in the 1960s. She battles drug and alcohol dependency as well as misogyny. University of Miami Frost School of Music professor Carlos Rafael Rivera scored the soundtrack for the show, and he won Outstanding Music Composition for a Limited Series. You're listening to the theme of the show right now. Let's revisit our conversation with Carlos from earlier this year. What was the decision to go with a more classical score? Was it the game of chess? Was it the era? Was it the drama of this young girl?
Well, personally, there's sort of two answers to it. There's like the personal motivator, and then there's what the director decides, which is what you ultimately do. And they happened to be simpatico this time. And the fact is that it felt like classical music was going to be needed because a novel actually mentions a lot more classical music. It even sometimes describes the chess games as it was like chamber music. Literally, I think that's one of the quotes from the novel. And also there's a moment when she's kind of left behind and some friends go to, some college friends that she kind of meets and has a party in one of the evenings. The next morning they go away. In the show, appropriately, she ends up listening to pop music because it helps establish the time. But in the novel, she listens to Vivaldi. So as I read it, I realized, oh my gosh, I'm in trouble because I'm going to have to write a music or the feel of it is going to have to be classical. And it truly lends itself because it's very linear writing. This point and counterpoint, which made me feel of a move and a counter move in the gameplay itself.
Yeah. How much autonomy do you have in the process?
None.
Ah. Dun, dun,
dun. No. It would be great to say, I have incense and I wear a robe and I kind of get creative. The truth is that it is a service industry. And what we're doing is we're servicing the story. And the director is our leader. And we all are kind of gathered together to kind of help that vision become real, whether it's the set design, which I love the fact that you mentioned that, and the costumes and the cinematography and the editing and sound design actually plays such a large role in the experience that kind of uplifts, that you find uplifting, or if anything, engaging as a story. And so I will write a lot of music, and because I have an unorthodox relationship with Scott in the sense that, I am on board really before even the screenplay is completely written, and I'm writing music to kind of help him see things through. Sometimes it influences scenes, and it's a real thrill for me to get to do that.
And so I'd imagine, as a professor, how do you use this with your students? How does this become a teaching tool?
Oh, it's one of the great thrills of my life. I've been teaching for like 20 years, at least in academia, and starting at USC in 98, I started teaching. And in 2010, I moved to the University of Miami, and I've been actually director of the media writing production program for the last 5 years. And so I get to teach. I feel like I get to teach this, because I'm a fan of this. Ultimately, I do this outside of my quote unquote day job, but my day job is as part of what I do as possible. And I get to bring back, what's currently happening and best practices from the quote unquote, I never thought I'd say quote unquote 70 times in one interview. So I apologize. but from the battlefield of writing, like I'm in the trenches and I come back and I tell them, listen, these are all the mistakes I've made. I screwed up here. I messed up here. I made a mistake here. I highly advise it against trying to do this as you're working on your storytelling skill set and through music.
Again, I'm talking with Carlos Rafael Rivera, professor at the Frost School of Music and the composer behind the hit Netflix limited series, The Queen's Gambit. Again, we've included more about the series and Carlos's work on our social media, so check it out at WLRN Sundial. And I'd imagine too, like anything in life, because as you said, look, these bigger projects, these are collaborations with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so, I'm wondering, like, that lesson for students, like, what do you tell them about, how to interpret a director's instructions and the writer's desire and the producers, what they want? I mean, what do you tell them about how to prepare for that?
I think we do spend an awful lot of time talking about the psychology of this, and mostly the fact that, as I said earlier, that I am in service of, if I understand my role in this part, in this game, I will probably have a good chance to succeed, at least see it through to the end. And that is really that you're servicing the story. I think a lot of folks that come into film scoring have, they read John Williams or Jerry Goldsmith, the older guard, or Alexander Desplat, and they go, oh, they must come in and command the room and just make decisions. And the truth is that all of them are serving the director's story. I also noticed very much the classical composers, because I have a classical background. So I was commissioned works and I would write a piece of music and there it is. It's submitted and you can hopefully play it. And I'd be grateful for that. But the difference for classical composers coming into this medium is that they're not used to rejection in that way. That, I've given you a piece of music, why don't you play it? Well, yeah. In this world, it's like, I've given you a piece of music and they're like, I don't like it. And they're like, but it but it's great. And they're like, yeah, but it could be great, but for another director, not for me.
Not for that. Yeah. Wait, so, you know what? I wanted to listen to a little bit of this, the main theme. And as we are, I wanted to get a sense from you again, what you were trying to create. And again, this is, I believe this is the main theme.
This is the main title. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how, you know, the process of creating this, and was it an easy sell?
This was actually, the longer version is that it was not quite an easy sell, but the short version is that it made it to the end. So I'm very happy about that. And it originally was approved by Scott at the end of 2018 as the screenplay was being finished. He hadn't shot anything yet. And I knew this would be the main title. I felt it really. And I submitted and it lived for a while in that sort of idea. And the principle behind it was that this, like an opera, there's always an overture. And the overture presents all these little themes that you're going to be encountering, right? Like think of Bizet's Carmen, like very famous overture. Well, this idea was to have this. And since it was going to play at the end of the story and the end of episode 7, you hear this for the first time. The idea was to kind of do like a, I don't know about the culinary stuff, but you know, when you have like a deconstructed bistec panisal and or like a deconstructed Cuban sandwich, and they give you a little piece of bread and maybe an olive and ham and separated. Well, the idea was to present all of this material throughout the story that would be building and building until we reached here. So all of the themes for most of the characters are in that little 2-minute sequence that you're playing in the background.
You know, I was thinking about this, like the future for musicians, because again, as you're teaching these students, you know, you're preparing them for the world. And obviously with the pandemic, one of the challenges is live performances, you know, have been put on hold for a while. But you know, one of the things that really blew up was obviously, you know, a lot of Netflix, a lot more movies, video games as well. And I know there's a lot of music in that as well. What do you tell the students about the future? Where are the best opportunities for them?
I'm always hopeful. I'm always optimistic because I am in a position of teaching. If I wasn't teaching, I wouldn't be able to give you an answer. I think that would be at least what I felt adequate. Or I give you an answer that I felt was adequate for my inexperience with them. But the fact is that students have so much more game than I did when I was a student. And they come in, they really come in with so many ideas that I'm like, oh my gosh, how'd you come up with that? And so I'm ultimately the learner. I always do feel that. And I feel our job is to help our students become better than us. And through the mistakes I make in the workplace of this writing for media, journey that I'm in, I get to share with them these things and they hopefully take those. When you're young, you're probably not going to listen to everything. You'll feel like, yeah, sure, whatever. And then you hit the wall by yourself, I guess, as we all do. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I get to present them the opportunity for that. And the truth is the field has exploded in the last few years and obviously for the worst reasons possible, the pandemic. And so content consumption has grown exponentially, and they are making it as fast as they can. So I think there is a thriving industry and opportunities for those who are entrepreneurial enough to find them.
That was University of Miami Frost School of Music professor Carlos Rafael Rivera, who scored the soundtrack for the show. He won Outstanding Music Composition for a limited series at last night's Emmys for his work in the Netflix series The Queen's Gambit. And you can find a full link to the conversation on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Monday, September 20th. Sundial senior producers Chris Remington, Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And by the way, the theme music for the program is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. Don't forget, you can catch a rebroadcast of this program tonight at 8 o'clock, or if you want, listen to it whenever you want. It's a podcast. Just look us up on your podcast app, WLRN Sundial. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, medical marijuana is a booming industry in Florida, more than $1 billion to be made this year alone. But there's only a couple dozen companies operating here in the state. The company, The Flowery, based in Homestead, is run by a family of former law enforcement and police. Senior producer Chris Remington has more on that story. And a reminder, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we are reading Infinite Country by author Patricia Engel. I know that name sounds familiar. She was one of the original authors when the Sundial Book Club started a few years ago. You can join the Sundial Book Club. Just go to Facebook, search Sundial Book Club, ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. We're going to be talking with her on Friday in a taped conversation, but we always invite our listeners to share their questions. If you're reading the book, and it's a great read, by the way, if you haven't, please get your copy now. Share your questions there. What would you like to ask her? And we will post those questions to her. The authors always love to hear questions from the readers. Again, that's Patricia Engel's book, Infinite Country. We'll be talking with her on Friday. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.